Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE for this evening's event. My name is Frédéric Brasseau. I am assistant professor in economic psychology at the London School of Economics. I'm with the Department of Psychological and Behavioral Sciences. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome Baroness Greenfield at the LSE today. Susan Greenfield is a British scientist, writer, broadcaster, and member of the House of Lords. She has held research fellowships in the Department of Physiology, Oxford, Collège de France, Paris, and New York University Research Medical Center. She is Chevalier de la Légion d'honneur, so it's very prestigious in France. So congratulations. I'm very impressed. She has been awarded 32 honorary degrees from British and foreign universities and heads a multidisciplinary research group exploring novel brain mechanisms linked to neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. She is a senior research fellow at Lincoln College, Oxford, and has currently co-founded a biotech company, NeuroBio, that is mentioned here, developing a novel approach to neurodegenerative disorders. Susan Greenfield has published 10 books for the general reader, covering various topics such as emotions, memories and desires, the neuroscience of identity, or the quest for meaning. Her famous book, The Private Life of the Brain, has been 9 years in Amazon's top 10 on books on the brain. It posits theories of consciousness that her lab is experiencing through experiments, evidencing through experiments. She is here with us tonight to present her latest book on consciousness, A Day in the Life of the Brain, a day-to-day study of consciousness. For just last words for those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Brain, because it's about the brain and we are at LSE, so it's very convenient, LSE Brain. I will ask you to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event, so please check this out. This evening's event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, after the lecture, there will be the chance for you to put your questions to Susan. You will find copies of the A Day in the Life of the Brain on sale outside the venue. And some of them are already, most of them actually, are already signed because sadly Susan will have to go straight away after her lecture and the Q&A session. But now, will you please join me in welcoming Susan Greenfield to LSE to deliver her lecture entitled A Day in the Life of the Brain, the Neuroscience of Consciousness from Dawn Till Dusk. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Merci. That's great. Well, good evening, everyone. Can I just ask how many people are going to be tweeting as I'm talking? I'll just be interested to know. Because I know it's the thing that people... Oh, there's someone, yeah. Because obviously, if you wish, but I'd much rather you actually listen and think to what I'm saying and tweet afterwards, but that's your choice, because obviously I hope that what I'm saying does require some reflection rather than an instant reaction. But anyway. Okay, so what we're going to look at then is this issue of consciousness through the prism of neuroscience. And in a sense, it's a rather contrived framework this day. As you'll see, it's the kind of day you might not actually want to have because it's full of issues. But on the other hand, it seemed to be an appropriate framework for exploring something that's really been a mystery and is the biggest question that anyone can ask, not just scientists. And neuroscience now is starting to make a contribution, and that's what I want to share with you today. Just to give you a heads up immediately, what I'm not going to be able to do is say how the water is turned into wine. What I'm not going to be able to do is say how the bump and grind of brain cells is translated into a subjective inner experience. What I am going to do, however, is show you that it's not all all negative and that we can actually perhaps come up with some constructive ideas and insights. So this is the hero of the story. Are there lots of people here who do brain studies, who are neuroscience? Yeah, okay, there's a line of them over there, one group. Well, forgive me, you specialists who are used to this, because I'm assuming the majority are not. I love this picture because it does really anchor you in what we're talking about, which is something you can hold in your hand. And I remember just such an occasion wearing surgical gloves, a brain when I dissected it as a student, and wondering if I wasn't wearing gloves, if I got a bit under my fingernail. You know, what would that be? Would it be what someone loved with? Would it be a memory? You know, could you have a habit like biting your fingernails under your fingernails? So really our challenge is, how do we start with this? And this is our start if you're a neuroscientist. And how do you go from that to an inner experience that I hope you are still having, unless you've already fallen asleep? You know, some inner. So it's almost impossible, because if I said to you, I've now got the answer, I wonder what you'd expect me to show you. Would it be a brain scan or a performing rat or a formula, or would you suddenly feel differently? We don't even know what kind of answer would satisfy the question. So having, I hope, constrained expectations, let's now think of how we go forward. Well, this is George Bernard Shaw, and I like this picture of him because it looks as though he's conscious. Yeah. But we'll never know what it was like to be him, like we'll never know what it's like to be you, to have this subjective inner world. Now, many people stop there because we can't define consciousness formally, and I'm sure there's some philosophers here who will take me to task on that. My answer is, well, the normal ways of defining things aren't very helpful when it comes to consciousness, because normally you'd define something with referral to a higher set. You know, a table is a piece of furniture. Love is an emotion. Consciousness is what's the higher set? It's very hard to think of that. Or you might have an operational definition. Flight is when you defy gravity. Consciousness is when you're not doing anything and you're still conscious. So therefore, the two normal strategies don't really work. And I think that's why philosophers despair, because we can't have formal definitions. But scientists, on the other hand, are rather pragmatic. And frankly, and I know this is going to make you wince, I'd like to say, look, we know what consciousness is. It's what you're going to lose tonight. It's what you lose when you're anaesthetized. It's this subjective inner world that no one else can share firsthand. However much you love someone, however poetic, however articulate, no one can experience what you're experiencing now firsthand. And that's what it is. And I'm sorry if you find that too trivial a definition. But if we're going to make any progress beyond the side of George Bernard Shaw, I'm afraid that's what we'll have as our working definition of what a subjective experience is. So here you are. Now we're starting the day. And you're in the dark. You're asleep. Okay. So that was really just to anchor the problem. And I think this one sums it up really very well, where you have two scientists. And notice how scientists are always portrayed. Yeah? And if you like, here we have the bump and grind of the brain cells, and here we have the subjective experience, and how one becomes the other, how the water is turned into wine. This is currently about the status of where we are now. Then a miracle happens, yeah. And as he says, yeah, I think you should be more explicit in step two. Yeah. So let's see if we can be more explicit in step two. So you've been in the dark and you wake up. Now the first issue then is, why does an alarm clock make you conscious? And I would challenge anyone who had a theory of consciousness to address that question first, because irrespective of your age, gender, culture, anything, a loud noise, as indeed a bright light, will wake you up. Now, why should that be the case? Well, let's have a think about that. Here you are asleep. Well, what we know about sleep is something rather interesting. Having just said, well, it's what you're going to lose tonight, it's not quite as simple as that. You may be aware that when you sleep, it's graded. You have stages of sleep. Okay, so here they are. That's REM, rapid eye movement sleep associated with dreaming. But as you can see, one can talk and accept quite happily depths of sleep. Okay, so what I'm wondering is, if one can have graded unconsciousness, could we not have graded consciousness too? And that's what I'd like to suggest to you, that if unconsciousness is variable, could we perhaps have a process in the brain and something we could look for where consciousness is continuously variable? Now, why would this be attractive? It would be attractive because it gives us somewhere to start. As you'll all be aware, people like to talk about science being all about measurement and quantification. And that's why I think most scientists, find the notion of consciousness really off-putting, because it is a qualitative process, or so it would seem. It's ineffable. It's hard to define. You can't actually measure it easily. But what if you could measure it? What if we could have... We talk about raising our consciousness and deepening our consciousness. It doesn't matter which way you go, but people traditionally will go and sit by mountains or lakes or special quiet places where they deepen their consciousness. So what I'd like to suggest is that consciousness is not all or none, but it is variable. It's on a continuum. And if that's the case, then we can actually make some progress because we can look in the brain and see physically in the brain, is there something that is changing in degree, in size, from moment to moment. Now, it won't be a single brain cell because they change slowly. Their connections change slowly over hours and longer, and they're long-lasting. It won't be a whole brain region because the brain doesn't have centers for this or that, as though they're all mini-brains. So we need something, don't we, between this top-down and bottom-up levels of brain function, which traditionally are not studied that well. People either normally study isolated brain cells and microcircuitry of neurons and networks, or they study top-down macro scale with brain imaging, non-invasive brain imaging, the activity of large areas and behavior. But that middle level, is there a middle level where something is changing from moment to moment that could possibly correlate, and I do stress correlate, match up with levels of consciousness? The answer is yes. I wouldn't have set up the question if there wasn't. So there we are, otherwise it'd be a very short lecture. What I'd like is, you'll see this metaphor introduced a lot, and it is, of course, just a metaphor, but the way I think what might happen if you say consciousness is continuously variable, it's a bit like ripples would be variable. The extent of the ripples in a pond would depend on the size of the stone that was thrown, the force of the stone, the viscosity of the fluid, and possible competition from subsequent stones being thrown. So this is very helpful in science because it gives us lots of different variables, lots of different factors that could change each time, giving unique excursion for the ripples. So if one accepts that, one can now start to think in the brain, well, are there ripples like this? And if so, how could we control them? By triggering with the stone of different sizes and force, with the viscosity of the fluid and so on. And that's what I'd like to explore with you now. So these are neuronal assemblies. Different scientists call assemblies different things, but in our lab, this is how we define them. And I'd like to suggest to you that these are the equivalent of ripples in the brain. So this is a living slice of brain, of rat brain, and at 1 millisecond, top left, we've stimulated here. And then what we've done is bathe the tissue in voltage-sensitive dyes. You can't do that in humans because the dye is toxic, but what the dye does, it embeds in the membrane of the cell. And as the voltage across the membrane changes, that says the cell becomes active, so the fluorescence properties of the dye will change. So this gives you, unlike functional magnetic resonance imaging, it gives you a direct and an immediate real-time output, an index of brain activity. And when you do that, as you can see, on a millisecond-for-millisecond time resolution, you can see that rather like, this is like the stone being thrown, you can see there is a spread of activity with the epicenter being in the middle. And you can see it's all pretty much over and done with by the time we're getting to 18 milliseconds, and I can assure you by the time you get to 50 milliseconds, 50 thousandths of a second, you're done. So this has the time requirements for consciousness, which is, of course, very fast, and at the same time, spatially, as you can see, the millimeter spale bar, these are, when you think a brain cell is about 40 microns diameter, orders of magnitude is different. You can see that this would encompass a large group of brain cells. So these neuronal assemblies, then, which we're going to look at, are like ripples in the brain, and they are triggered like ripples would be in a pond. So far, so good. This is the mid-level, and this mid-level would actually link the isolated cells of which they are composed with the macro brain regions, which they will then influence. Okay, so if that's the case then, with these neuronal assemblies, we'll define them as variable, highly transient, that's sub-second, macro-scale groups of brain cells, sometimes greater than 10 million, that are not confined to nor defined by anatomical brains. So this form of imaging is very different from non-invasive clinical imaging, where I've drawn parallels with those Victorian photographs where the time resolution is much slower, so you can't capture events like this. But here, given you're looking at a direct readout, that now is possible. Okay, so why does alarm clock wake you up? Let's think. That's talking about the throw of the stone. One can imagine a situation where the sound through the normal, conventional, well-known auditory pathway actually activates the appropriate number of cells, and because it's a very forceful throw, the noise is very loud, that will then cause the spread or the recruitment of an assembly, and that will be correlated with waking up. Okay, you then have breakfast. It would be nice to have a breakfast like that, wouldn't it? Most of us don't anymore. And this is for talking about, therefore, the senses. Now, I apologise, the Y seemed to have slipped again. I thought we'd corrected it. Anyway, what's very interesting about the senses is that people think one can actually divide them into purely or raw sensation and a so-called cognitive element, from the Latin cogito, I think, meaning it's some kind of context or personalised dependency when you have your particular access to sight, sound, smell, touch, or taste. So we're going to look at each of those in turn, because now what we're thinking about is the stone, the throw of the stone, and how we might translate the stone throw into sensory and cognitive elements like this. So let's take vision, which is very strongly cognitive, as I'm sure you're aware. When you look at something, you are looking at something specific. Yes, it might be a tree, a house, but it's a tree that looks like that, and it's a house that looks like that. And moreover, you have to focus, you have to put your eyes to it, you have to make a proactive effort to look at it. If you close your eyes, it will go away, so you're in control of it. And most probably, the image, because it is a literal image, could trigger idiosyncratic associations and meaning, such that it is a highly cognitive experience, as well as being, unless it's just abstracted or pixelated colours, which is rare in real life, you'll have, because it has such a clear pattern and a clear form, it will have a strong cognitive element. Next down is taste. Now, you might think that taste actually is pretty primitive and basic and raw senses. Not so. There's some remarkable work by Charles Spencer at Oxford, who's shown that the taste of something is influenced not only by your smell, of course, and we all know when you have a cold how you can't taste things well, but by other features such as the viscosity, the froth of the coffee you're drinking, by the temperature of the fluid you're drinking, and most intriguing of all, by the colour of the container that you might be drinking. Touch, and again, when you are drinking, so let me just go back to that, you are actually, again, having to be active. You're actually putting it in your mouth, and when you eat or drink something, you're masticating it or you're swallowing it. It's not a passive process. You're actually proactive. Next down is touch, which is, in my view, less context-dependent. Although velvet is velvet, it can be any kind of velvet anywhere. It doesn't have a very specific identity. And moreover, you're still, nonetheless, reaching out your arm, moving your hand across the texture. So when you touch something, it still has a proactive component, even though it's more abstracted. Okay, then we come on to sound, which, unless you put your fingers in your ears, which is rare, finds you. You don't find it. So now we're looking at something where you are more the passive recipient, and where, and I'm sure there may be music experts here, and I'm absolutely not one, it nonetheless conjures up associations that language does. And in the book, I actually compare language and what that offers and music and what that offers as two forms of communication that are very basic to human beings but very complementary. And then we come to smell, the most basic of all. I think you're probably all familiar with the primitive nature of smell and how powerful it can be. And that has very little cognitive component but is a very direct, raw stimulation of your sense. What's very interesting is it feeds into an area called the hippocampus, such that when the area degenerates in Alzheimer's, usually one of the first signs that you have degenerative disease is a loss of smell. Okay, so if you put those things... Oh, that's the taste and vision that I was talking about. There we are. This is... if you have hot chocolate in an orange cup, it tastes more chocolatey. That's clear. That's nice to know. So you can start economising the amount of chocolate you give people by serving it in an orange cup. And that's so this is the work of Charles Spencer, not mine. Smelling hearing synergise as well. It's been shown that if you have appropriate sounds as you're experiencing another of the senses, that enhances your perception of that sense. And we now know that the senses don't work in isolation, but they synergise to give you an experience that is very hard to deconstruct into, oh, I'm having a visual experience now, I'm having a hearing experience. They all come together. So as you're having your breakfast, you are smelling and hearing and touching, and there is a great combination of the senses. Now, if that's the case, that's great, but we still need to explore not just the force of the stone throw, the sensory component, but what would be the cognitive element, the context-dependent element. What I want to suggest is that when you throw the stone, the raw sensation part is the activation of the basic senses, but the cognitive part could be the size of the stone. So you have the force of the stone. Now we're going to focus on the size of the stone, and I'd like to suggest to you that can vary in size according to much longer-term hardwired, a term I don't particularly like, hardwired connections in your brain. So let's now not think about consciousness for a moment, but think about how personal experience affects your consciousness. How does what's happened to you already influence what you're feeling? And I'd like to suggest that this is the size of the stone. You might wonder who these individuals are. You might, I hope, recognize me in the middle, but that is the point. You won't recognize them. You could show me a picture of your friends or family or colleagues, and they would mean a lot to you, but they would mean nothing to me. They would be, as I imagine, these folk are generic men to you. So usually you can see they're wearing suits. I think we'd got some money that day. I think that's why everyone's looking so pleased. That's why it was such a meaningful event for me. That's why everyone's smiling. Yeah. So anyway, what could that be? How can we therefore personalize the world around us and create, if you like, potentially large stones in your brain so that if your senses activate them, they will actually contribute to the excursion of the ripples and hence your consciousness. Okay, so let's now think about then being born a human being. I like to compare us favorably with goldfish, where goldfish don't have great personalities, but we do. We are individuals, they are not. Well, you could, if one died, you could get another one and no one would know any difference. Sorry to sound harsh. In fact, someone's going to contest that it's not that goldfish have. Anyway, it was a separate story. So the wonderful thing about being born a human being is that we occupy more ecological niches than any other species on the planet because, although to greater or lesser extent, other species can be influenced by their environment, and we'll see that, we more than others adapt to our environment. We don't run fast, we don't see well, we're not strong compared to many species, but gosh, what we do better than other species is we learn. This is something that is well known in the brain now called plasticity, not meaning it's made of plastic, of course, but from the Greek plastikos, to adapt. And I'd like to suggest to you that this is what we could think of as the mind. So these are brain cells in the newborn brain. Forgive me, the neuroscientists are here, if I say the blobby bits of the cells, and I'd like you to concentrate on the stringy bits, which are the connections. And then we look at 3 months, 15 months, and 2 years of age, and you can see an astonishing change in the postnatal growth of the human brain, such that even if you're a clone, that's to say an identical twin, you are now going to have a unique brain. Why? Because you are going to have a unique configuration of connections in your brain because they have been shaped and triggered and turned off and on by your experiences, such that you become a unique person. And that's why I call this the mind, as opposed to the physical brain. The mind, as we'll see, is personalizing the brain through the connections. That is different in turn from consciousness, which is, as we've seen, something that is transient, something that you can lose at night, but at the same time, you don't say, I'm going to sleep and lose my mind, do you? On the other hand, you can blow your mind or lose your mind and you're still conscious. So I would argue for a distinction between those two terms. But we're concentrating for now on the mind and the size of the stone. So what do we know about that? Well, it will give you a personalized meaning to the world. So when you're a small baby, if you're exposed to this object, you might be attracted to it because it's a gold shiny thing. You might like the surface, you might roll it, you can stick things through it, but it won't mean anything. It won't mean anything. But as the weeks turn to months, turn to years, and say you interact with things like this, you will learn and remember that these are things that go on fingers. And then you'll learn, you can be more constrained, that a gold shiny thing, as opposed to other things that go on fingers, only goes on only one finger under certain circumstances. So you will learn, if you see someone with one of these things, it will say something about them that is not apparent from the intrinsic sensory properties of the object. And then, when you are older, you might acquire one of your own. And although it's pretty generic, it might be the most special thing to you, a unique object in your life that means more to you than anything else. And then, sadly, if you go from the honeymoon to the divorce, things may change, you know? And now it's the most bitter thing. And this simple object could conjure up so many associations and mean a whole spectrum of things to you. And a baby would just put it in its mouth. So what's changed? Not the thing itself, it's what's gone on up here that's changed, okay? The longer-term connections. Connections in the brain also help you in other ways. For example, here, this is a ghost, right? In case you wondered. Yeah. If I'd come on dressed like this today, I don't think anyone would have been frightened as such. But a small child, or indeed someone with dementia, would be very frightened. Now, why is that? It's because with dementia, you are unpicking all the wonderful connections that have been bespoke to you, that have been tailored to you throughout your life, that have given your life a meaning, a significance that is personalized. And sadly and slowly, those connections are dismantled. So with dementia, and indeed Alzheimer's, what happens is you recapitulate childhood and then infancy. You go back to being like a child who does not have the benefit of the checks and balances of those previously established connections. So now when you encounter something, an event or a person, what will happen is you will have to take it at face value. And if it's novel, it could well be life-threatening, and therefore you might be frightened by it. Whereas you, sophisticates, of course, would be able to put it into a context, the context of your previous experiences, so that you understood it above and beyond the senses. So you've been liberated from raw sensation to a more cognitive and personalized and individual idiosyncratic take on the world. And that's what connections do for you. Okay, so that, I'm suggesting, is the size of the stone. Now, what we're talking about here are connections formed relatively slowly, relatively local, and relatively long-lasting, as opposed to assemblies, which are the opposite. They're large-scale and they're highly transient. So the two are now going to work together. That is to say, the longer-term, more localized, so-called hardwired connections are going to give you, if you like, a more stabilized and longer-term individual mind. And then under appropriate circumstances, when the stone is thrown, when you have a certain experience, a certain sensory experience, that will come into play such that the two things together, the force of the stone thrown, the size of the stone, will determine the ultimate excursion of the ripples, the degree of consciousness. So I'd like to suggest to you that the mind is not some airy-fairy alternative to the squalor of the physical brain, as I think philosophers in the past used to think of it, but it's the personalization of the brain through unique dynamic configurations of your neuronal connections that are in turn driven by your unique experiences. And that's what I'd like to suggest the mind is. So you've now had breakfast, and equipped with your mind, you've gone to the office. Well, depressing place this looks. I told you it'd be a pretty gloomy life you're having today. So what do we know about the environment and how it impacts on our consciousness and on our state of mind? Well, we now know a little bit more about how the environment can indeed change the way we think and feel by virtue of the connections. And we have to, in order to really appreciate the nuts and bolts of what's going on, turn to rats, who also are pretty adaptable to life. They're very clever for their size. And they're also much more cooperative in experiments compared to humans in terms of what you can do. So you can't ask a rat to do sophisticated things, but you can ask them to experience a so-called enriched environment. And enrichment for a rat doesn't mean to say they come to the LSE and hopefully have a stimulating evening and meet lots of interesting people. This is what they want, yeah. So you can see how much lovely time he's having. He knows he's not in the control group, probably. This is from my own lab. The controls were just in ordinary lab cages, and this was the wonderful life that the enriched rats were living for about 3 weeks. So, and my graduate students really enjoyed making this. As you can imagine, it was huge fun. So they're having a lovely time. They're doing what rats love doing, which is exploring and interacting, and lots of novel things to play with, and so on. What you can do then is look at a single brain cell from such a rat and compare it with someone in a less fortunate situation, another rat. And what you see then, it's another experiment. For those of you who aren't familiar, the blobby bit is the main part of the cell, but I'd like you to focus on the branches. And compare a brain cell from a rat in a standard environment, such as this, with this one. And as you can see, the branches are more extensive. Now, why is that interesting or important? Well, you're all familiar with exercise, that you use it or you lose it. The more you exercise muscle groups, the more effective and larger they become. And if, as happened to my brother, you break your ankle, his calf muscle atrophied with alarming speed and became very weak-looking and small-looking because it wasn't being used. So it is with the brain. But the brain, if you make it work as you would in an enriched environment, or indeed, let's hope, at your office, where you're supposed to be, what will happen is it will respond by growing these more branches. Now, why is that interesting or important? Well, by growing more branches, you're increasing the surface area. And by increasing the surface area of the cell, you're providing an easier target for other brain cells to make more connections. And we've seen that being able to make connections enables you to understand things and personalize things in a way that merely processing raw sensation does not. So an environment such as one hopes, a stimulating work environment, should indeed enable you to have deeper understanding and to interpret things in a way that perhaps you wouldn't have otherwise. So this is actually therefore looking at now the effects of the enriched environment on the assemblies. And I lied a bit when I said that the controls were in home cages. This is a minimally enriched environment. I think my students felt sorry for the deprived rats, so they had a few polystyrene boxes to play with. And this is a typical assembly from the animal that we then anaesthetized and recorded from the outer layer of the brain and assembly. That's what that looks like compared to the enriched animal, where you can see the assembly is much larger after 3 weeks. So we know then that enrichment, your environment, is not only changing the local connections, the stone, but actually when the stone is thrown, the capacity, because it's a bigger stone, the capacity to generate more ripples, as you see here with the larger assembly. So if this enrichment enhanced plasticity increases assembly size, can we take that further? Could it work the other way around? If you have an assembly generator, could that enhance in turn plasticity? So what I'm suggesting is, say you have an ordinary assembly, and that is the status of your brain cells. Could it be that if such a brain cell has made a local adaption, a local change with other brain cells, if now you have a global, all-encompassing recruitment, thanks to the assembly, could that now enhance the plasticity? So could, therefore, something that I'm suggesting is correlated with deeper consciousness also enhance the plasticity? And if that's the case, then it would explain, this is just an idea, explain one of the questions people like to ask about consciousness, which is, what is the evolutionary value of it? I'd like to say, what's the evolutionary value of neuronal assemblies? Because they are large scale, they will amplify an event in the brain. So instead of just having a little local event, you've now got something that, if it's triggered, will actually affect many other brain cells. And if that's the case, then you could say that the function of assemblies, and tagging along with it the correlate of consciousness, is to facilitate coordinated global adaption to the environment. Global in the brain, I mean, not global environment. And if that's the case, you'd expect animals that adapt well to the environment to be capable of deeper consciousness, and I would point to us as wonderful examples of that, as opposed to the goldfish. So that's just one thought of how we might answer things. This is a lovely study of how experiences leave their mark on the brain of humans. It involved three groups of adult human volunteers. It's a very old study now, but it's wonderful. And they had to learn the piano. No one could play the piano. And if ever you get the chance to volunteer for something like this, again, try and not be in the control group, because they stared at a piano for 5 days. Okay. And what I'm going to show you in this remarkable experiment is, over 5 days, the astonishing change in brain territory, that's to say the potential size of the stone, even over 5 days. But there's something that's even more surprising. If you look at the controls compared to the people that learnt five-finger piano exercises, and I'm going to keep you in suspense about a third group, because they're really quite remarkable. So these are controls, and you can see the brain is literally unimpressed. We're going from left to right. Yeah. Physical practice. Can you see the astonishing change in the size of the stone? One could almost think of it like that. The third group, which are the most exciting, are these. These people asked to merely imagine they were playing the piano, and the reason this paper has become a classic is because this is what they saw. That is to say, that what's really important is not so much the contraction of the muscle, but the thought that has preceded it. That's really exciting. And that's the study. As you can see, it's very old now. So that does beg the question, what is a thought? When you're having a thought at your office, what's happening? How can we have a handle on what a thought is? I think we can do that as often by contrasting it with something that's not a thought, like a feeling. And I'd suggest to you that, you know, a cat purrs, a dog barks, you shriek or cry or scream, but when you have a thought, it's something different. Whether it's a business plan or a logical argument or a story, it can be anything. You end up in a different place than where you started. A equals B, B equals C, so therefore A equals C. So you've ended up in a different place from where you began, i.e. you've incorporated, unlike with emotions, you've incorporated a time frame and a linearity that you don't need with an emotion that's just there and in the moment. And how did you get to that different place from where you started? or by a sequence of steps. Things happen, one thing and thing next. And what's remarkable is the man that developed the treatment for Parkinson's disease, a man called Horner-Kowitz, in the last century, came up with this wonderful quote, which I think summarizes this and summarizes what I've just suggested. He said, thinking is movement confined to the brain. There you see it, thinking confined to the brain. So this is something that requires a lot of neuronal machinery because you're going to make steps and you're going to have to do it over a window of time. So here you are living your life. Yeah, downtown Oxford, this is, yeah. Everyone in this picture is just like everyone in this hall. You know, we all have a unique trajectory in time and space. For the moment now, the present you are experience is informed very much by your past and indeed, I would suggest, by your future. It's beginning, middle, and in the long distant future, end eventually. But it is nonetheless a linear path. You can't go back to being 5 years old again. Your beginning, middle, and end. It's this linear path. It's a story. It's your identity. It's a life story. And this is what gives you a meaning to your life and gives you a sense of identity. It's something above and beyond raw consciousness. I don't think a cat would have a sense of their life story, or indeed a very small child would. So this is something that comes. The wonderful birthright of the human brain is as you mature to develop this wonderful mind that is going to give you a notion of identity throughout your life, and it's all due to the connections in your brain. Okay, so if that's the case then, what can we say about the environment of humans as opposed to rats? Because remember, you're in the office at the moment. Yeah. The first is the physical space itself is important. Colour, and I had great fun researching this. And Frederick and I were talking about how under-researched architecture and neuroscience is, and I now have a chapter on the book in that. So where colour, photos of a natural environment will help, sight of natural scenes, different types of seating, how you circulate, aspects of the physical space seem to play a very important part in people's well-being. Then you have the interaction between the individual and that space, like how much are you going to have spontaneous meetings, where's the water cooler where you might have a chance encounter, how much do you walk around, how much of your space has to be personalised to you that's not invaded, and how much not. These are all fascinating issues that I think perhaps have not been thought through fully when people plan out work environments. Then there's the subjective reaction of you, the individual, according to your individual identity and how you see the world. So these things are all relevant, and I couldn't resist showing you this. This is from Innocent Drinks headquarters as a very unusual space, which I think we'd all like to work in with AstroTurf and booths and so on, where one can combine interacting and private spaces and so on. Okay, what's really interesting, I talked about the environment or pictures of it. Better still is to get out walking in it. And this is a study by Berman et al. Showing the cognitive benefits of interacting with nature. What they did in this study was to take ordinary adult volunteers and subject them to a test for creativity and cognition. And then half the group, again, the poor old controls, had to go to downtown Michigan somewhere. And the lucky ones went to this arboretum. That's just a generic picture, but they went to an arboretum with lots of trees, and they found the people that had the exposure to the rural environment were better off than the ones in the city. Now, that might be, I just reflect for a moment on that, because when you're in an urban environment, you are very reactive. You have to dodge the way of the cars. You have to avoid other people who are shoving past you. You're not really in complete control, whereas when you're in a natural environment, not only is the colour beneficial, the colour green and so on, and the smells much more accentuated, but you decide at what pace you're going to walk. You decide what direction you're going to go in. You decide to stop and pick up the flower or stroke the bark of the tree or whatever you do. But nonetheless, it is very much a proactive experience, much more than being in a bustly city street is. So here you are then. What you're doing now is you're walking your dog after having had breakfast, after the office. Why should that be interesting? Well, that gives us a chance now to talk about animal consciousness and whether animals are conscious or not. So what is animal consciousness? I love this picture because I'm sure many of you may have pet dogs and you would absolutely avow the dog was conscious. But is the dog conscious like you? Really? And if it is, when do you draw the line? You know, is a rat conscious? And if a rat, is a lobster conscious? Some think it's not. Jerry Adelman, for example, I think probably likes eating them, says a lobster's not conscious. But this is a question we need to pause and think about. And I think here we should look at some anatomy, because where is the anatomical Rubicon that would decide whether an animal is conscious and another one not conscious, and I would suggest there isn't one. Although, obviously, different species have very different brains, the theme is the same. For those of you who aren't familiar, there's this cauliflower bit at the back, which is the cerebellum, the stalky bit, which joins the spinal cord, the outer coating called the cortex, which can be wrinkled or smooth according to how much you're trying to cram into the skull. But the theme is the same. There's no magic brain area that some species have and others don't. So therefore, we have to think very carefully about disenfranchising animals from being conscious or not. And yet it is hard. So this I owe to someone called Toby Collins, who was a marine biologist who then came over to neuroscience, and he pointed this out to me. The octopus vulgaris, common octopus, is very well used, has since the times of someone called J.Z. Young, in memory experiments. It has government protection. If you wanted to work on memory experiments in octopus, you'd have to have a Home Office license. Do you remember the octopus Paul, who obviously conscious, because he used to predict the football scores, do you remember? The World Cup sometimes, sadly now no longer with us, but he was obviously conscious, yeah. So that's the octopus. But the Elegantia hosa, which I gather is a closely related species, there's no legislation on that. So you can see how arbitrary and inappropriate it is to draw lines and attribute consciousness to one animal and not to another. And I think we should take the safe bet, assume all animals are conscious. Anything with a nervous system is conscious. But if that is the case, you can't really say that some octopus is conscious like a human. So how do we get around that? Well, we have to think about where consciousness begins. And again, the very controversial issue of whether a fetus is conscious or not. If a fetus isn't conscious, then let's have that as the null hypothesis. When does it become conscious? As it squidges down the birth canal? Yeah, but say you're born by cesarean section, what then? Yeah. Or exactly at 40 weeks, what if you're premature? Does that mean, you know, for the first few weeks you don't bother seeing the baby in the hospital because it's not going to be conscious anyway? Or, you know, and suddenly, it's conscious today. Clearly an absurd. So again, and this is an issue that I don't really want to go into in terms of ethics, but I think I reject the null hypothesis. I would submit that the more likely scenario is the fetus is conscious. Now, if that is the case, is it conscious like us? Surely this is the same question as the octopus. Yeah? So how do we get round that riddle? Oh, let me get round it. Well, the way we get round it is to think about consciousness being continuously variable. That is to say, a lobster is conscious, not as conscious as a dog or cat, and they're conscious but not as conscious as a primate. And a fetus is conscious but not as conscious as a child. And a child is conscious but not as conscious, as I've just suggested, as an adult. So if we think of consciousness like that, that is very helpful. And then you as an adult human being will be more conscious at some times than at other times. So if we can think of it applied to you in your individual life, we can also apply it in the animal kingdom and indeed to generalized development. And that actually does help us answer those questions rather than dismissing half the animal kingdom or indeed perhaps making hasty assumptions about the fetus. The next question is, how do we explain the difference in subjectivity of hearing and vision? Now, this might seem obvious. We all know what a sound is like, and we all know what hearing is like, and unless you're something called a synesthete, which are a very small minority of individuals who can experience more than one sense when others experience just one, on the whole, the brain is processing the thing the same. So if you have a bell ringing in your ear, after it's transduced from the cochlea, that signal is converted into strings of action potentials. These are the electrical blips which signify activity of a cell as it communicates with another. If you have a light shining in your eye, then that is converted again to these electrical blips. So the electrical blips are the same, and they're processed in the same way. They route through different brain areas and then up to different bits of the outer layer, but we know those outer layers can be quite malleable and changeable, and they're like a cookie cutter anyway. So after a sense has been converted into brain language, if you like, it's the same. And yet we have distinct experiences. So if we could say exactly what happens when you are hearing something as opposed to seeing something, that might help us understand how the water is turned into wine. Now, conventional physiology is of little help in that, but assemblies can be very useful. And this is a paper we did a while ago comparing the visual system with the auditory system. So these are assemblies in the outer layer of the visual system where after 300 milliseconds, this is important, you can see the red blobs, the epicenter, are deep into the brain, as opposed to the auditory system where the reverse has occurred. So physiologically, what we've done is to show you can differentiate hearing and vision, in brain terms. But how do we map that onto the subjective experience of hearing versus vision? And there's the problem, because here we can use assemblies as the common yardstick for evaluating one sense against another. But how would you do that with the subjective experience of hearing and vision? How would you explain what vision was and, as opposed to hearing to a Martian, for example, the subjective experience of it? And the only way I can think of this, and this is still rather general, is that vision is detection primarily but not exclusively of discrepancies in space, whereas hearing is detection primarily but not exclusively of discrepancies in time. So could we therefore think of comparing or understanding what's going on here with these assemblies along a continuum of space-time? I don't know if there's any physicists here. I'll confess I'm certainly not one, although I have been working with one recently. But I have a hunch that this might help us very much if we think about space-time rather than isolated space versus time in terms of trying to understand how the senses could be processed in this way. So this is the article that we wrote, if you're interested. And as I said, this only happens after 250 milliseconds, and that is the same window, that's the same epoch that subjectively people have recorded for consciousness. So you can give someone a stimulus, and although the brain registers it, it's only much later, a quarter of a millisecond later, that they will be aware of it. And so that's the time for the spread of an assembly. So that's why I think it can be useful in trying to help us understand it. Now, what about if you're excited? You're at the office, remember? But you're not very excited, or are you excited? Perhaps you've just got a pay rise. Perhaps you've just met someone interesting. How does your arousal affect your consciousness? And what we're talking about here is the viscosity of the fluid. We've looked at the force of the stone and the size of the stone, and now we have to think about how the effect, the ripples, might be hampered or might be facilitated by the thickness, if you like, of the fluid. And what I'd like to show you is in the brain, sort of fountains, sorry to have these watery metaphors all the time, but noradrenaline, dopamine, acetylcholine, dopamine all emanate from a primitive part of the brain, and instead of being one-on-one transmitters, they act more like fountains, what we would call modulators. They can change the sensitivity of the cells to how they're going to respond. What's very interesting about this group of chemical messengers is they match up or change with the diurnal rhythms, with sleep, wake, dreaming, excitement. They will all peak and surge in different ways at different times. So you can imagine, according to how excited you were, you would have a different degree of consciousness according to the availability of these compounds. This is the only technical picture I'm going to show you, because it proves to you, I hope, that what modulation is. Here you have a stimulus. These are the action potentials in the thalamus. These are the blips that brain cells generate. Acetylcholine, when given, does nothing on its own. It's modulating by making the cell more negative inside, such that when the same stimulus is applied, now very clever ions go into the cell because of the voltage requirements. We won't talk about that. So now you have facilitated response. Here, the opposite has happened. The same old transmitter this time has closed off an ion channel, so that now instead of this handbrake that's normally there here, it's now facilitated. I know that's a complex thing, but I think it's important. I wanted to include it to show you that one of those chemical fountains, and they're all like this, do nothing on their own, but in the context of a stimulus. It's a bit like, let's go back to the office, it's a bit like there's a rumor going around, there's a pay rise in the offing, and then the phone rings, you're going to pick up the phone perhaps with greater alacrity than you would otherwise. Yeah. So the rumor is like in a way, it's like the modulator. So now let's put all that together. You see someone, let's see your mum, and that activates through the visual system a certain group of cells according to how meaningful your mum is to you, let's hope a lot. This will be the size of the stone. So this is the force of the stone, this is the size of the stone. Let's say you're excited about something. Now that puts the cells on red alert, and according to these three factors, that will determine at that particular unique moment of time, one-off unique type of assembly that will be your consciousness or correlated with your consciousness. That's the ripples. So here we have a modulator that actually underlies excitement and indeed all drugs of addiction. And that's a reward, in case you wondered what that was, reward. And this is dopamine, which is another of those chemical messengers. And what's very interesting, and this brings in another factor, is dopamine isn't just a modulator, but it has a particular effect on the frontal part of the brain that is unique to human beings. Well, not unique, its size is unique, it's there in primates, but it's particularly dominant in humans. It's an area called the prefrontal cortex. And It's well known that dopamine inhibits it. Here it is shown in turquoise. It's a sizable part. It doesn't have a single function. It's the notion of single functions of brain region is something that I reject anyway. Needless to say, what's very interesting, it only comes on in late teenage years. It's fully developed only by your late teenage years. It therefore reflects evolution, as some might say, ontogeny reflects phylogeny. That is to say, individual development reflects evolution, where in humans this is much more exaggerated than other species. What's interesting about it is when it underfunctions, for example, in schizophrenia, as shown here, and the similarities that has, therefore, when with children who don't have it functioning either, both are easily distracted, both have short attention spans, neither can interpret proverbs. If you say to someone with schizophrenic or a child, what does it mean, people who live in glass houses mustn't throw stones, they'll say something like, well, if your house is made of glass and I throw a stone, your house will break, which is, of course, true, but it's missing the point. Yeah. Another group of people that have an underfunctioning prefrontal cortex are people with a high body mass index, that's to say people who are heavy with respect to their height. So how can we link that with schizophrenia and childhood? Well, what's really interesting is that anyone who eats, and as a consequence of eating, but the sensation, the taste of the food, trumps the consequences. Another example of people who have an underfunctioning prefrontal cortex, and indeed people who are heavy, have a high BMI, are actually more reckless in gambling tasks. This has actually been shown in those references. So again, it's the thrill of the roulette wheel or the roll of the dice that trumps the consequences you're going to lose your money. And then in schizophrenia, it's a very famous set of paintings. Everyone would recognize that as a cat, but by the time the conditions advanced, no one would recognize that as a cat. And I think that's the clue. In all cases, these three very different scenarios have a common feature, which is the sense is trumping the cognitive. So if you have an underfunctioning prefrontal cortex, surely you're now having a dominance of the senses over the cognitive. So let's think about that a little bit. Two basic modes for the human brain. And I'll suggest that the small assemblies, because they are dependent just on a forceful stone, not on a size of the stone, would be underfunctioning prefrontal cortex, as opposed to large assemblies that where thought dominates, it's more cognitive. So in the small assemblies, you're living in the here and now. Here, you're past, present, and future. Here, an external stimuli is dominating. Here, internal thoughts and processes dominant. The world has little meaning here. Think of the wedding ring of the small child. Here, the ring has a lot of meaning, personalized. Think of the wedding ring. Here, there's a reduced sense of self. You're not self-conscious when you're very young. Here, you have a strong sense of self. Here, there's no time, space. You're just there. Here, there's a series of episodes, your life story. Here, this is mainly infants and children, older children and adults. And what's very interesting is during your childhood that you have the biggest surge of dopamine ever as opposed to later. So these could be two methods of development. But what's really interesting is sometimes we pay money to go to the left-hand column. When we talk about wine, women, and song, or drugs and sex and rock and roll, we are predisposing ourselves to this environment, this experience. That's to say we're taking agents that will disable or impair or slow down these lovely connections. You're putting yourself in an environment that where the premium is on the beat of the music or the flash of the lights or the white foam. So techno, sort of like this. It's a world stripped of all cognitive content. And we talk about, do we not, having a sensational time. If I said, now let's go out and have a cognitive time, I don't think anyone's... well, that's what you're having now. You're having a cognitive time. And it was ever thus. This is from Euripides. I don't know if there are any Greek scholars here, but 500 BC is BC. This is from the Bacchae. This is the king Pentheus. And what he wanted to do was suppress these wine-crazed women. Look at them. They're worshipping the god Dionysus. And what's going to happen is that, if you want to know the end of the Bacchae, he gets torn apart because he doesn't heed the wise Tiresias, who says, no, there's two forces in man, wine force and the bread force, and you need both, i.e. the prefrontal cortex and the underfunctioning prefrontal. You know, you need times when you let yourself go, you blow your mind, you lose your mind, you're out of your mind. The very word ecstasy in Greek is to stand outside of yourself. You're still conscious, but you now have a surge of dopamine that's disabled the prefrontal cortex. And then you need the sense of identity as well to balance it. So here are people who have blown their mind. I'm going to show this one day, and this guy will be a professor on the front row probably somewhere. So you have a sensation time, you let yourself go. This is the sort of thing one might pay money to do, whitewater rafting, where the foam doesn't have a meaning. It's there by virtue of its sensory properties. And here a selling point from Queensland, I couldn't resist this. the selling point was to be out of control. You're not in control anymore. You're just there in the passive recipient of your senses. So could this be then small assembly mode? Because all it requires is strong sensations at the expense of cognitive idiosyncratic. So this is stones very forcefully thrown. Okay, so there you are at the office. Now you're going home. Don't we all feel like this a lot of the time? And you're depressed, of course. Yeah. So I told you this is a somewhat contrived day. Now, what's really interesting about clinical depression is one of the features is the inability to experience pleasure, anhedonia. And people who are clinically depressed say they feel numb. They don't feel anything. They just feel numb. And again, we know that depression is correlated with an imbalance of those modulatory fountains, hence the success of Prozac in increasing the availability of the chemical fountains like serotonin. How that happens and why, we can discuss later. Suffice it to say, the modulatory fountains do play an important part. People who are depressed feel a disengagement with the outside world. They feel it's grey and remote. So as opposed to the very interactive world of the small assemblies, where the sensations bombard you and you're living in the moment and reacting to it, and even in schizophrenia, where they overinterpret the brightness and the flash, so they have a very short attention span, are very interactive, almost too much with the outside world, and in some cases they feel it's coming in on them. In depression, you're grey, remote, you're distanced. So a greater sensitivity to pain. Now, what could we make of that? People, whoever wanted to do these experiments on depressed people is horrible, but they are formal studies of giving depressed people pain and asking how much pain they feel. And they feel more than non-depressed people, so-called hyperalgesia. So what do we know about pain then, linking to depression? Why is pain perception variable? Because it is. And I'd like to suggest to you that the larger the assembly, the greater the pain, and vice versa, and indeed that depression is characterized by abnormally large assemblies. So pain is expressed as other associations, pricking, stabbing, burning. So one can see that there would be a link there that would necessitate having a big assembly. There's diurnal threshold to pain, again, rather nasty experiments where you keep electric shocks through their teeth at different times of the day. The middle of the day, your threshold is higher. And that's not because the conduction velocity has changed, but more the chemicals that are fluctuating will modulate the ripples to greater or lesser extent. The greater the anticipation, the greater, if I say I'm going to hurt you now, I'm going to really hurt you, here I come, hurting you, as well as you just have the pain, you feel it more. Phantom limb pain, and you may be familiar with the lots of work by someone called Ramachandran and then Mount Sycamore. Amputees still feel pain in the severed limb. And that's because of the lack or inappropriate now feedback into what we would call, they called it the neuronal matrix, I would call an assembly. With morphine, obviously a painkiller, people say that the pain no longer matters. It's not longer significant anymore. They still feel it. It's as though, and we know this happens, the assembly's got so small by virtue of the morphine acting on naturally occurring chemical targets from a naturally occurring transmitter, naturally occurring endorphins we have in the brain that would make the assembly smaller. And when you have morphine, the analgesic, people say it's a dream-like euphoria. Ah, cue for dreams and think about what dreams are. And again, anesthetic action would be explicable in that what would happen, and this is again from our own work, this is a lightly anesthetized rat and this is a deeper one, and you can see the assembly's got smaller. So the actions of anesthetic, which have been a puzzle because they don't respect particular brain regions or particular chemical messengers, I think work at this next level up at the action on the holistic assembly. Now, what's interesting is as you were losing consciousness, as you were getting the assembly smaller, if I was right, that would mean as you were undergoing the early stages of anesthesia, you would get extreme pleasure and excitement. Seems an odd idea. But that's exactly one of the stages of anesthesia, which is hyperexcitability. And moreover, drugs of abuse can also be anesthetics. Ketamine in low doses is a drug of abuse, in high doses an anesthetic. People used to have ether frolics and take nitrous oxide, all of which to make them feel high and happy. And these, of course, are anesthetic agents. And so I think that actually is consistent. What about dreaming? That's a set, because now you've gone to bed, you've gone home, and you're dreaming now. Well, I'd suggest that that is an example of a weakly thrown stone. We've seen that the alarm clock wakes you up, but if you had intrinsic activity that was sufficient, then that might intrinsically in your brain actually generate more modest ripples such that you didn't wake up, or you might if you had a nightmare, but if it was very big, but it would be sufficient to give you some kind of strange internal narrative. The standard things on brains... obviously document and map various different brain regions, but I'd like to suggest to you that a much more straightforward way of understanding dreaming is small assemblies, because they'd explain, as one would like, lots of things. For example, smell, which is an externally driven sense primarily, as we saw, it's the least cognitive, is largely absent in dreams. We know that if you're sleep-deprived, you start to get psychotic, almost as if, because you can't establish your connections, you are therefore reduced to a small assembly mode. Lucid dreaming, which we're familiar with when you know you're dreaming, rapid eye movement sleep, and non-rapid eye movement sleep, which is even less consciousness, can be explained along a continuum of quantity, not quality, of size of assembly, these different types of dreams. It also explains the paradox that the infant and the fetus maximizes, they have a lot of time in dreaming, and yet they don't have any difficulties to resolve, do they, in the womb. So this notion that dreaming is to resolve difficulties, I don't think stands up, because in the younger brain, in the brain in the womb even, you have dreaming. But on the other hand, we do know dreams can be related to real life. So if you think of it instead as the formation of the connections, and this being a state that is a very primitive form of consciousness, I think that, as witnessed by small assemblies, then that can actually try and reconcile the top-down and bottom-up theories of dreams, namely that on the one hand, you only dream about things you've experienced, or more Freudian symbolic idea that the dreams are much more complex top-down reflections and symbols of much less literal things. So now we have tomorrow. Here we are, you've been asleep, now it's tomorrow. What does tomorrow hold? Well, I'd like to suggest that in this brief talk, we can now, as I promised you, look at the factors that would govern a neuronal assembly. So you can now be bilingual, if you like, with the assemblies being like the Rosetta Stone. We can talk in physiology terms about neuronal activity. Phenomenologically, that's intensity of the senses. You can talk about pre-existing associations, which would be significant. Availability of modulators is arousal. Availability of other modulators, which we haven't mentioned, would be hormones that give you predisposition mood. The formation of competing assemblies would be distraction. Input from the prefrontal cortex would give you a life narrative. And so, therefore, I'm suggesting that this optical imaging could reveal factors. We could dissociate and differentiate those different factors to actually predict the size of assemblies and, therefore, a way of linking phenomenology and physiology. Now, you can't do optical imaging in people because the dye is toxic and embeds in the neuron, but this is the work of Brian Pollard in Manchester, where he's introduced an ingenious technique with a very high time resolution, faster even than our optical imaging. And he claims and very graciously acknowledged our work on assemblies, saying that this actually gave some credence to this being linked to consciousness, and that was the publication. So the generation of consciousness, then, you start with hardwired group of cells that reflect your individual experiences over the years. They're then stimulated by your senses, and the extent of the associations coupled with the senses will determine the impact that the activation of that hub has. Other factors will be the availability of modulators such as dopamine and serotonin, and indeed of hormones, and indeed then of competing assemblies. How fast are they coming? Are you a techno-techno, or are you at a mountain by a mountain? Which is it? Yeah. So I know techno is probably way out of date. So, you can correct me. So all this will give you, from moment to moment, a net size of an assembly. Now, I'd like to stress I'm not saying that this is consciousness, but I stress it's an index of consciousness. How does it now talk to the rest of the body? Because we know that the immune system and the endocrine system all work with the central nervous system to give you the holistic experience that you're having. Well, in these cells in the brain, you don't just have the classic transmitters. You also have a second group of chemical messengers called peptides, and we know that they're released under different circumstances according to activity. So this gives each assembly a unique signature of quality and quantity that could never be replicated exactly. So it's a unique moment, and I think that could account, as we have to do, for unique moments of consciousness. So these circulating peptides, which are also released from the gut and the other systems, will feed back as well as iterating. And it's this iteration that is giving you what you are experiencing now, unless you've fallen asleep. So where we are at the moment is being able to look very precisely at neuronal assemblies to try and deconstruct them, to break them down into different components so we can make predictions, i.e. falsifiable hypothesis, with what it's all about. And I'd like to think, in the words of Scarlett O'Hara, The miracle, you know, might one day happen of turning the water into wine, but then, after all, there's so much excitement in Hindu, and tomorrow is, after all, another day. And this is a shameless plug for the book that says it in much greater detail and precision than I've been able to do here. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me? Yeah? Thank you so much for your lecture. We'll now open the floor to questions from the audience. And please let us know what is your affiliation, who you are, and show that you would like to have the mics. For instance, we have a question here, please.
Hi, thank you very much for a very interesting talk. My name is Laura Kutrina. I'm in the Department of Social Policy here. I study socioeconomic status and happiness.
And happiness?
Yes, happiness. Okay. I was wondering, you talked about schizophrenia and you talked about Alzheimer's and also depression. I was wondering how bipolar disorder and any other mood disorders fit into your framework of smaller assemblies and larger assemblies.
Okay, well, actually, I do cover that in the book. I'm not going to say this as a mantra, but what one would imagine there with bipolar is you're oscillating wildly between an abnormally small assembly and an abnormally large assembly. So they're unstable. And what's very interesting about bipolar is the standard treatment is lithium, which is a very boring salt, yeah, which is very similar to sodium, okay? And sodium is the first stage of the action potential. So in a way, it might be, at a very simple level, stabilizing the excitability of the cell so that instead of being extreme one, then veering to extreme other, it's a more stable scenario. Hence, that's why lithium is effective in the way that it's not effective for other conditions.
Yes. Hi, my name is this on? My name is Gideon. I'm just passing through.
Just passing through. That means you're probably a philosopher, not fessing out to it. Yeah.
I've studied psychology, but never neuroscience formally. Mm-hmm. So, as far as I understand, your definition of consciousness is the subjective experience, and you've demonstrated that that's influenced by the environment, because that will create the connections in the brain. Mm. But can you talk about the difference between that and your awareness of that? So I'm basing my question on my understanding of Buddhist psychology and the distinction between awareness of the subjective experience and the experience itself, which to me seems quite obvious that it's a biological or a chemical set of chemical reactions.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you asking me to differentiate awareness from consciousness, or are you saying that there's something other than chemistry within the brain?
Because you've distinguished between humans and animals, let's say. Mm. You're saying that humans might be more conscious, but my understanding of that was that the subjective experience might be more complicated in humans. Mm. But I think but your ability to be aware of your subjective experience,
sure,
for me, seems more likely to be what I would think is consciousness. And then a lot of the things that you're talking about, a human has the ability to direct his awareness to a particular thing, depending on the importance that it has, and that would have an impact as well on the...
Yeah. Okay, so if you're defining that as consciousness, then that disenfranchises most other animals. Would you be comfortable with saying a dog wasn't conscious then?
No, because a dog is aware.
Oh, so you're saying why? Okay, so this is semantics.
The story that we have is more complicated.
Okay. Again, this highlights the issue of words and definitions. Yeah? I personally am most comfortable talking about the subconscious, unconscious, conscious, and self-conscious, almost along a spectrum. When one uses another word, it can be dangerously like a synonym, such as aware. And I think there, one runs into confusion of whether it's transitive or not. Are you aware of something, or are you just aware? Yeah? So I'm not sure how much that actually helps. I think we would both agree that humans have more complex and varied experiences, subjective experiences, compared to other animals, but other animals also have subjective experiences. Now, the words we use, of course, can vary, and no one says, that's what I said at the beginning, the problem with defining consciousness, no one has a formal definition. So I think what one should focus on is not so much fretting too much about the words we use, but the ideas behind those words. And I think, from what I've heard you say, I don't think you and I would disagree about animal consciousness and human consciousness.
I have a question. Yeah,
my name's Christina, and I've been very interested in the brain. I've followed your work, and what I find a little bit disturbing sometimes, and you've spoken about words, is that I understand that the concept of plasticity in the brain, the fact that the brain can be retrained, and I think in Norman Doidge's work,
yes,
The Woman with
yes,
Half a
Brilliant
Brain,
book, yeah.
Yeah, which is amazing. So I get a little bit concerned about the words of hardwiring, because it suggests that the brain is just a computer or a machine, and I really think we need to get away from that.
It's
much more complex.
Yeah, I think I did say, I said an expression I don't like. The reason I use it is because a lot of people use that expression, yeah? But I couldn't agree more. I really jib at the idea that the brain is, quote, like a computer, and we could go into why it's not like a computer if you wish. And in a sense, it's not hardwired. Really what I mean when I use that term, and I did do the caveat, is that it's longer lasting than the assemblies, that it's more local and it's more fixed than those assemblies. But I don't want to say absolutely on the record, I don't like the word hardwired either. Yeah, so.
A question from the top, please. Here.
Hello, thanks for a very interesting talk. My name's Irving Rappaport. I'm just off the street as well. In my day, I occasionally like to go to the hypnotherapist. And sometimes my hypnotherapist, who's a very good one, is able to make my hand go completely numb so that she can put a needle through it and I don't feel a thing. How do you explain that, please?
Okay. Oh, I could have, and all she did was words. It wasn't. She didn't do it. She didn't know no other pins in you or anything like that. Okay. So one might imagine that she contrived a situation. I'm just thinking aloud here, that put you into such a small assembly mode that you were so relaxed, almost asleep, such that if we're saying pain requires and is mediated by a large assembly, rather like with morphine, now you're having a small assembly. Oh, yeah. Well, it's not that funny. Possible. Very plausible. Yeah.
We have another question here.
Yeah. Who's
Hi there. I just graduated from UCL in the cult of neuroscience. I've been consciousness kind of my main interest, and I really like what you did with it. I kind of feel like the elephant in the room is what exactly you mean with assemblies, because it's kind of almost implied that there's only one assembly.
No, okay, thank you for that, yeah. Well, for the point of experiments, there is only one assembly, and that's what I showed. But again, what I discuss in the book is what must happen in the real brain, yeah? So assemblies are real phenomena, they're not metaphors, you can manipulate them, you can see them, and so on. So, and we've published a lot. Yeah, now let me finish, yeah. Let me finish. So assemblies exist, right? They absolutely, but in experimental circumstances, the way you contrive to see them is either in an anaesthetized animal looking just at the cortex or in a brain slice. Now this means what you do is you stimulate with an electrode or you flick a whisker. So you're looking in a very artificial reduction situation, not just one assembly that you then manipulate. In the real brain, as I suggest in my book, this doesn't happen. So the big question then is if you have multiple assemblies in the brain, how do they come together in some kind of meta-assembly that would be the single moment of consciousness that you have? And that's why I've been working with this physicist called Francesco Fermani, and what we've done is model how this could happen in the brain, which means we had to abandon biological science in order of theoretical science, because given the brain is three-dimensional and you then have to have the fourth element of time, you can't experiment on that, but you can model it, and that's what we have been trying to do. And my own view is that within a certain epoch, say 250 milliseconds, the interesting thing is the end, because it's at the end when people report consciousness. So as the energy is decaying at the end, where does that energy go? There could be a collective whereby that then is the meta-assembly, and that is the moment of consciousness. But yes, thank you for allowing me to explain that I'm not for one minute thinking that you've only got one assembly going on in your head at the moment. But for the point of experiments and the mechanistic deconstruction of them, we do reduce the situation to one assembly, yes.
Can I just ask for one nuance? What do you personally suspect is the meaning? Is there like a role for the distribution of assemblies and the size of these assemblies? So you say that in dreaming, mm-hmm. it might be just smaller assemblies, but maybe it's a distribution that changes.
Well, no, because what's the beauty of them is that they are highly dynamic. Yeah, they are not determined by hardwiring. And what we do in the book is to show they're not determined by purely synaptic transmission, but also by gap junctions, which you all know about, which are the fusion of cells, and also by something called volume transmission, which is not synaptic transmission, but where more like with the modulators, you have so you have three forms of signaling going on that have different requirements in terms of the space they will cover over a certain time. And you can analyze those three things to look at the dynamics. So it's not dependent on the literal anatomy, although that obviously is a requirement, but more on how those three signaling systems work together at any one moment.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got a few more minutes on that.
Okay,
can I just say, sorry, if you don't have time, you can always write to me on my website if you have a question. Yeah.
A question at the top.
Hi, I'm Paris Du, a member of Public. We know that children learn language at the age of three or less than three. Do we have any good consciousness level for learning?
Consciousness level for learning? Okay, so we know that non-linguistic, like a rat can learn, but we do know language aids and abets things hugely because it provides you with the ability to vocalize about things that are not in your particular senses at the moment. You can talk about something that's not there. And so you can talk about yourself with a personal pronoun. There's also the idea that language provides what's called a structured string. That is to say, the very sequence I suggested was the essence of thought because it's a sequence. So it's not to say you can't learn and you can't think, but by having a formal way of structuring things like that, that greatly aids and abets that process, and one would argue, therefore, is perhaps the prelude to self-consciousness and deepening your consciousness. One more, and then I have to go.
You pick.
No, I've got to pick someone. Okay, I'm going to be sexist and pick
so
a lady. One of the lady in the red. No, because I like to promote women talking. Yeah. Lady in the red. Yeah. It's furthest away from the microphone. Yeah.
Thank you for a really interesting talk. I'm studying a master's in philosophy. This may be a really simple question, but it came to mind when you said fetuses can dream. It just made me wonder, can they also have nightmares? And that's my question.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because a nightmare is something, it's an interesting question, is negative. I would have thought not, because what bad could have happened to a fetus? Or, you know, what could it anticipate that was bad that was happening? I think the consciousness is so primitive and so basic that it probably doesn't have good, it probably doesn't dream of happy things either. You know, it's probably just a very primitive form of consciousness that doesn't have a content of that type, yeah, I would imagine. So that's a good thing to end on, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you want to...
Okay, so thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If you want to write to me, dear.